Our project, remember, is to find out how quantum fluctuations of the so-called inflaton field, which is a scalar Klein-Gordon field, could have created the inhomogeneities in the universe, the quantum fluctuations. So we will do two things today. We will consider the impact of non-adiabaticity on both particle production and the amplification of quantum fluctuations of the fields. We have some tools for both already, but today we'll compare that. And we will find that in both cases, non-adiabaticity is the key. Non-adiabaticity gives you Bogoliubov beta coefficients. Remember the alpha and beta coefficients? The alpha ones, they come about even with just the rotation, right? But the beta coefficients are those coefficients that if they're non-zero, you have particle production. And today we will see that it's exactly also the beta coefficients that give you an amplification of quantum fluctuations, makes them bigger. So that's one thing we will do. And then we will start applying the machinery that we developed to an actual FRW spacetime, namely the Sitter space. The Sitter space is the simplest kind of accelerating spacetime, and we take that as our starting point, the easiest to work with. But of course, later we will make it more realistic and talk about FRW spacetimes that are a bit more realistic than the Sitter space. But today we will start with the Sitter space. Okay, but the beginning, first part of today's lecture is about the impact of non-adiabaticity on beta coefficients and therefore on particle production on one hand and the amplification of quantum fluctuations on the other hand. So let's remember, we assume that our system, that is to say our quantum field, is in a state zero, which is the vacuum at time eta naught. And then, because it's the Heisenberg picture, this is always going to be the state of the system. And all of the time evolution is in the operators of the quantum field, and in particular in the chi operators. So we solve for the time evolution of the chi operators, which, if you remember, are not exactly the phi operators. They are A times the phi operators, A being the scale factor function. So the time evolution then of our field variables, chi, is given by these mode functions. And remember, these are the mode functions whose corresponding A operator annihilates a vector zero, which by assumption is the vacuum state at the beginning, determined, for example, by the adiabatic vacuum identification criterion. So we chose for convenience these mode functions, because that allowed us to identify that state with the vacuum state. Now, the technical challenge is then this. First of all, to identify exactly which are the mode functions such that this is the vacuum state, and as I said, adiabatic vacuum identification criterion, all we need to do is look at the time evolution of the scale factor function. And from that, we can derive what the initial conditions are for this mode function. And then once we have V and V prime, then by the Klein-Gordon equation, we can evolve this mode function forward in time. And therefore, we obtain the solution at all times. Right? So this to solve the quantum field theory on curved space-time or on an expanding space-time background boils down to this. At an initial point in time, we identify the vacuum state by the vacuum identification criterion, which boils down to setting initial conditions to the mode functions, namely what the amplitude and the derivative is. And then the Klein-Gordon equation allows us to calculate what the mode function is at all times, and this gives us the field operator at all times, and hence we've solved the problem. Because we know the evolution of the phi operators and therefore also of the pi operators at all times. And therefore we can make predictions for everything at all times. In particular, we can predict the size of the quantum fluctuations. And remember, the fluctuation spectrum is by definition what we call on the left-hand side the delta phi k of eta. That's the standard deviation of the fluctuation of the quantum fluctuations of the mode phi k. You can also interpret it as the amplitude of the correlator between points that are 2 pi over k apart. And this fluctuation spectrum we found in the previous lecture always to be k to the 3 half, and then the mode function corresponding to the field chi divided by the scale factor function. Or we can also say this itself, the V over A, is actually the mode function for the phi field, for the original field phi. Either way, everything is known here. We know what the scale factor function is because we, by assumption, legislate what it is. It's not arrived at dynamically. We just assume that it is a scale factor function for, let's say, the Zither space or a power law expansion and so on. And then from that, we get the initial conditions for the mode functions. We can calculate the mode functions. So everything is calculable. We get the power spectrum as a function of time, and that's what we will study today. So what we're interested in is phenomena where this fluctuation spectrum increases, where we get more fluctuations than Minkowski space would give us. Now, as we already established that even in Minkowski space, we have these quantum fluctuations. And if we express k as 1 over L or 2 pi over L, then we know, remember, that this behavior is like 1 over L. That's the Minkowski space behavior. Except if there's a mass term, then in the infrared, it goes like 1 over L to the power 3 half. But the promise of the whole program here is that we will find a mechanism to that shows us that these quantum fluctuations can be enhanced, can be enlarged. It's this plateauing of that curve. So in which circumstance would that happen? Well, the circumstance would have to be that this V, this mode function, grows in modulus. So how can it do that? Well, let's see. The mode function is the solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. And here is the Klein-Gordon equation. Remember, in the chi variable, there is no friction term. In the chi variable, it's just second derivative plus frequency squared times chi is equal to 0. Just the harmonic oscillator that's parametrically driven. Namely, this parameter here, the frequency parameter, is time dependent in this harmonic oscillator. And then we said, ha, we expect something weird to happen when omega, the frequency, goes imaginary, which means that the omega squared goes negative. When that happens, this is no longer the equation of a harmonic oscillator. It's the equation of an inverted harmonic oscillator. And when that happens, then it's just no longer oscillating. This thing has a continuous spectrum. All states are unbounded states. It's completely different from the regular harmonic oscillator. Namely, the regular harmonic oscillator has this paraboloid as potential, and the ground state, for example, is a Gaussian. So a quick decay for large modulus of x. But under time evolution, the omega can go negative. This potential can flatten and eventually invert, and then everything completely changes because now it's the physics of a particle that sits on top of a hill and then rolls down. Of course, it's not a particle, it's a wave function. So what happens is that this wave function flows apart very fast. We have these runaway solutions then. No particle picture because the particle picture relied on the discrete equidistant spacing of the eigenvalues of the harmonic oscillator. So there's just no particle picture in this case. Now, I should caution you here not to take that intuition as being fundamental physically, because we are working here with the chi field, not the phi field. The chi field has this behavior, but the chi field is not the physical field itself. It's the phi field. And there's a big difference between them. And when the chi field is running away and is exploding, which means that the mode function is exploding, right? Because the mode function is the function that is solving the Klein-Gordon equation. The mode function is initially oscillatory, but then eventually it will blow up. It will have some exponential behavior, in fact. I mean, it can have an exponential behavior. It depends on what the a of eta is, what the scale factor function does. But it can blow up because that thing is inverted. So this could mean that we might expect that, therefore, the quantum fluctuations completely get out of hand and explode. And they don't. And they don't because there's something else that blows up. There's the A of eta that also blows up, the scale factor. And as it happens, as we will see, they are competitive. And this thing will explode the same rate that one does. As the universe expands, the V will expand. And that goes back to the fact that the Klein-Gordon equation for phi actually has a friction term in it. And in the moment that this harmonic oscillator gets inverted, what does it mean for the friction term? Well, it means that the friction takes over. The friction dominates the evolution, and the waves actually freeze in place. That's actually already a classical phenomenon, because you could solve the Klein-Gordon equation for a classical field. And in fact, I'm looking for an opportunity to measure that in an experiment where you would have a Klein-Gordon wave, or just any wave for that matter, most decompose into Klein-Gordons once you do the polarization separately. So you have some sort of field that lives on some membrane or string or something like that, which is expanding rapidly. And the speed of propagation of the wave, like the acoustic speed, could be such that if the expansion of the underlying medium, a trampoline or a rubber band or something like that, if that's fast enough, if it's accelerated enough, we might get an acoustic horizon. And if that happens, the Klein-Gordon equation predicts that the oscillations grind to a halt, because that expansion leads to a friction term then. I'd really love to see that. Anyway, we're dealing with the quantum version of this. And what this friction term taking over means is that both of them grow very fast, but the ratio asymptotes to a constant. Okay, but for convenience, we are working with the chi field, and it's that interpretation here that matters. And remember that the particle interpretation is the same between the chi and the phi. They just differ by a scale factor, a prefactor, but the particle interpretation, the creation and annihilation operators will be the same except for prefactors. So let us now look at of course we want to calculate the fluctuation spectrum of the fields, but let's look at it from both perspectives, particle creation and amplification of field fluctuations. What's the relationship between them? Well, let's say we've already done what we said we would do up there, namely at the initial time we identify the vacuum state that gives us the initial conditions on the mode function. And so we then calculate the mode function at all times, the mode function whose corresponding A operator annihilates a vector zero that is the vacuum state early on. That was at eta naught. At an initial time, that's when we identified the system is in the vacuum state. So it's in the state zero. And because we can solve for the Klein-Gordon equation at all times, we can calculate the full evolution. But now let's say at some later time, eta one, we again ask the question, which state is the vacuum state? Which state in the Hilbert space is the vacuum state? We don't expect this to be the state of the system. It may or may not be, but we don't care about what happened before. We just ask, which state in the Hilbert space is the vacuum state now? So for that purpose, you need to apply the vacuum identification criterion at the time eta 1. This gives you initial conditions at time eta 1 for the mode function. And again, you can calculate that mode function at all times. Okay, so let's say the if you have calculated that mode function at all times, we will call it V tilde. And the V tilde comes with its A and A tilde and A dagger tilde. And the A tildes annihilate a vector 0 tilde. That's the zero vector, that's the Hilbert space vector which describes the vacuum at the time eta 1. Now, there are two cases. One case is where the evolution between eta naught and eta 1 was adiabatic. And the other case is where it wasn't adiabatic. Let's start with the case where the evolution was adiabatic. So the evolution of our mode was adiabatic from eta naught to eta 1. So it was slow enough. There was no drama in the expansion of the space-time. The space-time was expanding slowly as compared to the frequency with which the mode is oscillating. And typically, that's easy. Like, consider the light in this room. These waves are oscillating at higher than terahertz rate, right? It's like zettahertz or whatever. That's optical frequencies. And within like 10 to the minus 15 seconds, space is not expanding significantly. So it's very much adiabatic. Let's assume we're looking at such a situation. The evolution from eta naught to eta 1 was adiabatic. And what that means is that when you applied the adiabatic vacuum identification criterion at eta naught, you got a mode function V. And when you apply the adiabatic vacuum identification criterion at time eta 1, you get another mode function that we might call V star. But those two mode functions are the same. They are the adiabatic solution. That was the point of choosing this as the adiabatic vacuum identification criterion. Namely that during adiabatic evolution, whenever you apply your adiabatic vacuum identification criterion, it will point to the same mode function. So therefore, to the same AA dagger operators, and therefore, the vector zero that you get at any point in time as the vacuum vector is the same vector all the time. So therefore, the state of the system early on, which is also the state of the system later, was the vacuum state early on and is the vacuum state later. And that's because the vacuum identification criterion always points to this mode function, right? It's always 1 over square root of omega of eta, and then the integral here. That's the adiabatic solution. That's the solution to the Klein-Gordon equation whenever the evolution is sufficiently adiabatic. Now, but let's look at it. If the mode is evolving in time, even be it adiabatically, the omega of it can change in time. But that means that even though this is a phase, and therefore it will not contribute to the calculation of the modulus of V, and it's the modulus that enters into the calculation of the spectrum, remember? This is the spectrum of the quantum fluctuations. It's the modulus of V. The phases never matter for that calculation. So what we see is that, yes, there's some non-triviality here in the mode function, this one, but it doesn't enter into the considerations of the size of the fluctuations, but the 1 over square root of omega does. The omega can change over time, and therefore the size of the quantum fluctuations does change. So what we see is that even in adiabatic evolution, the size of the quantum fluctuations of the field in the vacuum state is changing. So that would indicate naively huh, we don't have particle creation, but the size of the quantum fluctuations changes. Doesn't that contradict what I said earlier, which is that it's exactly the beta coefficients that determine both particle production and quantum fluctuation size changes, amplification of quantum fluctuations. And it's still true. The reason why the quantum fluctuations do not stay the same over time is a trivial one in this case. It has nothing to do with amplifications because of adiabaticity and so on. No, it has nothing to do with that. The reason why this modulus is changing is simply that the wavelength changes. Right? If you have a laser beam that has a certain wavelength now, well, a billion years later, it has a much longer wavelength. And we know that the quantum fluctuations are the size, the amplitude of the quantum fluctuations depends on the size, on the wavelength that we are considering. Remember that we had this 1 over L curve where we saw that for small distances, for small lengths, for small boxes, we have large fluctuations. And for large boxes, we have small fluctuations. And as a wavelength is being stretched, it gets into the larger size territory, and therefore its fluctuations diminish. That's perfectly normal. So that's nothing to do with amplification. If we track, and we will do that in a moment, the physical modes, not the co-moving modes, but the physical modes, we will see that if there is no expansion, then the quantum fluctuations always stay the same. And if we have expansion and we track it, we will find that those wavelengths that have this, that if you look at waves of the same wavelengths, they always have the same amount of fluctuations. So that doesn't change. It's not really dynamical. The fluctuation spectrum doesn't change because of that. We're just looking at these things differently over time. Like a laser beam that's blue now will be red later. But we will see that come out in explicitly. So let's now look at the case number 2. Case 1 was between eta naught and eta 1. The space-time doesn't really do anything capricious. It's just evolving adiabatically. And the vacuum state stays the vacuum state in this case. But now case 2. Let's say the evolution was not always adiabatic between eta naught and eta 1. That could be, for example, the situation at the very beginning of the universe when we had a period of very fast inflation, almost exponential inflation, and that cannot be said to be adiabatic. In this case, namely, if and only if the evolution was non-adiabatic, the vacuum identification criterion applied at time eta naught gives you one mode function. And then applying the vacuum identification criterion at the time eta 1 gives you another mode function. That's exactly if and only if the evolution was non-adiabatic. So this means that what used to be the vacuum state is no longer the vacuum state later on. Now, how can we relate these things? Well, you know the drill, right? We calculate the Bogoliubov coefficients. We know that even though V tilde is a different solution to the Klein-Gordon equation than V is, well, the space of all possible solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation is only 2 complex dimensional. So we are guaranteed that we can express the V solution, for example, as a linear combination of the V tilde and the V tilde star, because V tilde and V tilde star together form a basis of the solution space, just as V and V star would. So we are sure that there are Bogoliubov alpha and beta coefficients that relate the V's to the V stars, the V's to the V tildes. Well, this means the following. We can now go back to this formula and say, in this formula for the fluctuation spectrum, we can replace V by its expression in terms of V tilde and V tilde star. That will allow us to express what happens to the fluctuation spectrum in terms of the Bogoliubov alpha and beta coefficients. So let's do that. So we have here the expansion of V in terms of V tilde and V tilde star with Bogoliubov alpha and beta coefficients. And then we plug that V into the formula for the fluctuation spectrum, namely this one. This is the same equation as the one that I just showed you up there. I just squared it. Up there, it was without the square, without the square. Here was a 3/2, and there was no square. So this is the variance. Without the square, it's the standard deviation. So that spectrum, therefore, is given by this expression here. V is given by alpha V tilde plus beta star V tilde star, just substituting this in here. And let's say that at time eta 1, the non-adiabatic crazy stuff that the universe might have done is over. So just for conceptual ease for the moment, let's assume that we started out with an adiabatic space-time. It was evolving slowly. Then it did whatever it needed to do. It was a non-adiabatic. And then by time eta 1, it is again adiabatic. Or even Minkowski space by time eta 1. If we choose it to be Minkowski space at time eta 1, then the advantage is that we know what the mode function looks like. We know what it is from the very beginning of our course. That's the mode function then. And then, and if it's the adiabatic, if it's not exactly Minkowski space, but it's evolving adiabatically, then it's only a slightly modified formula because we have an integral here then. But it's easier if we just keep it like this. And it doesn't change the overall qualitative behavior. So what do we find then when we express the size of the quantum fluctuations in terms of the Bogoliubov alpha and beta coefficients? If we plug it all in there, we get to square this. Right? We have alpha v star plus beta star v tilde, but we have to square it. We have to take the modulus square of it. So we have to multiply this with its complex conjugate. That's why we squared all of that, because otherwise we would still have to take the square of it and then take the square root of it. So this is what we obtain when we square this. We get, of course, an alpha alpha star term. We get a beta beta star term. But we also get mixed terms, where we have alpha beta star and alpha star beta. So overall, we get alpha squared, beta squared terms, and then we get, because there are two mixed terms, it turns out that it's just the real part of two times real part, and then the alpha, the beta term, and then this oscillatory thing. You see, here we have an alpha times alpha star, and that comes with the V times V star, and therefore the phases go away. And here too, the beta times beta star, the phases go away. But when we have here alpha beta and alpha star beta star, we get the phases that are still there. Yeah, we don't have the V's anymore because we chose for the V this, right? And so the phases go or do not go away. Here they do go away. Here they don't go away. And then the 1 over square root of omega becomes, when you square it, a 1 over, 1 over square root of omega becomes 1 over omega. So that's how we obtain that. Now, in here, we have very simple terms, alpha squared and beta squared. But this one looks a little messy and time dependent. And it turns out that we can, in effect, neglect that term in almost all circumstances. And the reason is that that oscillation is really fast compared to what else is going on. It's like the oscillations of the waves in the laser, for example, they're tremendously fast compared to whatever else we do. And so if we perform, for example, if we make an observation, cosmological observation, and we check what the quantum fluctuation size is, then we will not be able to resolve any such quick things. So these average out in effect. So what we have is that the power spectrum of the fluctuations is given essentially by alpha squared plus beta squared with these prefactors here. And we should remember that there's a relationship between the alpha and the beta Bogoliubov coefficients. Remember, that relationship guarantees that not only are we going from one solution to the Klein-Gordon equation to another solution of the Klein-Gordon equation. No, when we do that, when we express V as a linear combination of the V tilde and the V tilde star, we also must make sure that if V tilde obeys the Wronskian condition, the V also obeys the Wronskian condition, and that imposes a condition on the alpha and the beta, and it's this one. So that condition allows us now to express everything in terms of only alphas or only betas. Now, we are interested in the betas because we know they are indicating non-adiabaticity. So we use this equation to replace all occurrences of alpha by occurrences of 1 plus beta. If we do that, then we can express the power spectrum in this way. The power spectrum is therefore prefactor stuff, that's this, where all I did is that I spelled out what the omega k of eta 1 is. The omega k is the square root of k squared plus m squared a squared. That's from the harmonic oscillator equation for the chi field. And then this term becomes just a 1 plus 2 beta squared. So what we notice here is that we get a term, the one here, we get one term that doesn't depend on the beta coefficients and one term that does depend on the beta coefficients. So this we would have also in the adiabatic case, but this term is arising in the non-adiabatic case only. Remember that the beta terms have a direct interpretation in terms of the number operators and their expectation values. If we take the number operator built from the late a tilde and a tilde dagger, I mean from the a tilde and a tilde dagger, if we take that number operator, so if we ask how many particles are we detecting later on, so we calculate for the initial vacuum state the expectation value of the number operator at the later time at eta 1, remember, what we get is the beta k squared. That's the expected number of particles that has been produced under the assumption that there is a particle picture. The calculation can be done anyway. Whether it can be interpreted in terms of particle numbers is a different story. So the cool thing is that this formula applies no matter what, whether or not the evolution was adiabatic, or even whether or not the evolution is already adiabatic again at eta 1. We can take it at face value anyway. The calculation can be done anyway. And that's important because even when this interpretation fails, namely the interpretation that non-adiabaticity produces particles, when that fails because the harmonic oscillators are inverted and we don't have harmonic oscillator spectrum and the excitation of particles, then the size of the quantum fluctuations of the field, the amplitude, the standard deviations of these fluctuations, that can still be calculated and interpreted. It can be interpreted because what that refers to is like the two-point correlator, like in practice that boils down to the two-point correlator of the temperature fluctuations in the sky, or also it can refer to the standard deviation of the quantum fluctuations averaged over a box, as we said. Therefore, from a cosmologist's perspective, or from the perspective of somebody who does quantum field theory on curved space-time, it's quantum fields that are more fundamental than quantum particles, because the notion of particle can fail, but we can always calculate what the fluctuation spectrum is of a field. This is to be contrasted with what particle physicists often say. They say in our detectors, we never see fields, we always see particles. And so they might be inclined to say, oh, they're only particles. The fields are just a mathematical construct that we use to calculate scattering amplitudes of what are actually particles. Now, I said that the time dependence of these quantum fluctuations that we have even when there is no non-adiabaticity. See, even in the adiabatic case, we get this term. That one is zero in the adiabatic case, but we get that term, and it's time dependent, which might indicate, oh, there is perhaps an amplification or suppression of quantum fluctuations as a function of time. That term, remember, I claimed, is actually innocent. It doesn't describe anything cool. It just describes that as the wavelength changes, we are looking at different wavelengths, and we know that at different wavelengths, at different sizes of boxes, different sizes of distances of correlation functions, we get different amounts of quantum fluctuations. So let's put this to the test and prove this. So for that, we take this equation and we rewrite it in proper variables. So let's define d to be the proper length. Remember that l was a co-moving length. It's a co-moving length, right? That's when the co-moving length is 1 light year, well, then it might be a proper length of 1 light year now, but later it'll be much later, much larger, right? One co-moving length unit grows in actual distances. And the relationship is this, right? So if your proper distance and then the co-moving distances times the scale factor, that's what the proper length is. And for the momenta, of course, it just goes the other way around. The proper momentum goes like 1 over the scale factor times the co-moving momentum. So therefore, we can now take this formula, this one, same here, and express it in terms of the proper variables. So what we can do is we can express it in terms of p, the actual physical proper momentum. And when we do that, we just substitute these 1 over a, we substitute for k the a times p, then we get this expression here. And we can cancel out various factors of a, and we find this expression. And now we can check whether it is true that when the evolution is adiabatic and therefore the beta coefficients are zero, then nothing funny is going on with the size of the quantum fluctuations. They're always the same. And now we see that this is the case. Because in the adiabatic case, the beta coefficients are zero, and we get this. And we see that the quantum fluctuations are, but the size of the quantum fluctuations as a function of p, the physical momentum, is this. And that's not time dependent. Right? So for fixed given physical momentum, that's the size of the quantum fluctuations of that. And you see, for example, if the mass is equal to 0 there, you get a p squared, which is a 1 over l squared. If you take the root of that, it's a 1 over l. So we get the usual 1 over l behavior of Minkowski space. So this first term here only has time dependence because we choose co-moving coordinates. In reality, the only thing that messes with the size of the quantum fluctuations is non-adiabaticity, and it increases the amount of fluctuations. If you start with a vacuum, it increases the amount of fluctuations always. Okay, any questions so far about this? Because now we have we switch gears and we leave behind the study of the quantum fluctuations of the fields and the quantum and the generating of particles, where, remember, the main message was We can always calculate the fluctuation spectrum of fields even when the particle interpretation breaks down because of non-adiabaticity. No, actually, I should say the particle interpretation can still hold for non-adiabaticity, but there is such a thing as too much non-adiabaticity, namely when the harmonic oscillator inverts. Then it's so dramatic, the non-adiabaticity, that we don't have a particle picture anymore. Okay, if there are no questions, we can now move on and prepare the ground to apply all of this to an actual FRW spacetime. And the first one that we will apply this to is the Sitter space. Now, most of you may have seen, will have seen the Sitter space before. Here's the basics again. At the Sitter, Friedmann-Robertson-Walker-Lemaître spacetime can be defined in many different ways. But for our purposes, the straightforward way to define it is to define it through by simply giving the scale factor function a of t in proper time. And in proper time, the scale factor function is e to the power ht, where h is the so-called Hubble parameter or Hubble constant. So what we see here is that this is a space-time that is exponentially fast expanding and that had no Big Bang. Because you can take t arbitrarily negative, and the scale factor gets arbitrarily small, but never zero. There's no singularity in this. The Sitter space doesn't have that. It just keeps going and is always just expanding exponentially. Where if h is a small number, or h is equal to zero even, then it's Minkowski space. But if h is a very small number, then it's expanding very, very slowly. I mean, it's still exponential, but with a small coefficient. And that's probably a good approximation to what the universe is doing now. It's basically in a de Sitter phase. It appears to be in a de Sitter phase where there's a small, very small h. And we need to explain why it is so small. Because the vacuum fluctuations of fields, remember, should produce an enormous amount of vacuum energy, which should show up as a contribution to h. But it would be more than 120 orders of magnitude larger than what we actually observe. Big mystery. OK, so h is a positive constant that is called the Hubble constant. And there is much more that can be said about the Sitter space. It's a very interesting model of a space-time. But we will just need this perspective, and then we will move on to more realistic space-times. If you're interested in the Sitter space itself, look it up in the book by Mukhanov and Vinitsky that I'm linking to in the homepage. There is a more extensive treatment of the Sitter space. But what is most important for us, we will now do explicitly. First important thing, most important thing, is that the Sitter space has a horizon. Just like a black hole has a horizon, the Sitter space has a horizon. And that horizon can be studied both in the particle picture and in the wave picture. It means something for particles. It means something for individual observers, astronauts, residents of a galaxy. But there's also an interpretation, there's also a meaning of that horizon for waves. And these two considerations are really quite independent. The first one is about whether or not two observers can communicate with each other. That's the particle interpretation of it. But the wave interpretation is very different, because waves can be very large. I mean, let's assume a plane wave. It's just extending infinitely far. And then we can ask, what does it mean for a wave of a certain wavelength to live on the background of a de Sitter space with some horizon? And it turns out it makes a huge difference whether the wavelength is smaller or larger than the horizon. When the wavelength is much smaller than the horizon, everything is as usual. If the wavelength is much larger than the horizon, then those friction terms kick in, and it freezes the oscillation. It freezes everything, including the quantum fluctuations. OK, but we start with the particle picture. So we ask, what does the horizon do for us when it comes to the communication? And the claim is that objects or observers who in the Sitter space are further apart than the proper distance of distance, Hubble distance, d index h equal to 1 over h, 1 over the Hubble parameter, can never meet, cannot communicate. So concretely, it means that we can, for example, let's say we have a pen pal in a neighboring galaxy, and we wonder, can we communicate with them? Yeah, it will take a long time, but in principle, will the signals reach them? Or could it be that the two galaxies will drift apart fast enough so that light cannot catch up with it? And the critical distance there is this, 1 over Hubble length, 1 over Hubble constant. That's the so-called Hubble length. Let's prove this. So let's consider an observer in a galaxy A, could be us, for example. And let's choose to create a co-moving coordinate system at which we are the center. So our coordinate is 0, 0, 0. And now, let's say that we send out a message to a friend in another galaxy with a radio signal. And we do that at time ts for signaling. So at time ts, we send out that message there. And remember, so far we are working with cosmic time. It's the proper time of somebody who is just going with the Hubble flow, just going with the expansion of the universe without having peculiar velocity. So somebody who is addressed with respect to the cosmic microwave background frame. Which means in practice that somebody who doesn't have a peculiar velocity should see the average temperature of the cosmic microwave background to be the same in no matter what direction they are looking. It's just the practical way to do it. For example, we know our peculiar velocity because we know how much red and blue shift we have in the direction of travel relative to the cosmic microwave background. So we are assuming that we don't have a peculiar velocity. We send the signal out at time ts towards the other galaxy B. And then how can we calculate how long it takes for the signal to get there? Well, the signal travels at the speed of light, which means that in a small time interval delta t, cosmic time, in a small time interval delta t, it will travel a small co-moving distance delta x. Let's start with a co-moving distance. So what we have is that this has to be done by the speed of light. But that's the proper speed of light. The speed of light is a speed limit in proper distances and proper time. So what we have is that the ratio of proper distance traveled over proper time that it took for that is equal to c, the speed of light, which we set equal to 1 in our units. But if delta x is a co-moving distance, then a times delta x is the proper distance. So proper distance divided by proper time is speed of light, is 1. But that means that the speed in co-moving distance, in the co-moving coordinate system, is time dependent, right? So the speed of light in co-moving coordinates is different. And what we have is that dx by dt, the speed of light, is given by 1 over a of t, because we just divide that equation by a of t. And then we have the delta x by delta t, co-moving distance divided by proper time, that's 1 over a. That's for small changes in co-moving distance and small change of proper time. So in the infinitesimal limit, what we have is that dx by dt is 1 over a of t. And this means that we can integrate this up. See, we have that dx by dt is 1 over a of t, and a of t is the exponential. 1 over a of t is e to the power minus ht. So this means we can now calculate, by integrating this up, what the co-moving distance is that our signal has traveled as a function of proper time, just integrating this. And by integrating this, we obtain this term, that's the antiderivative of that, and then plus an integration constant. And that integration constant, we can choose to be such that, we have to choose it such that it fits our initial condition. Namely, the initial condition is that at the time of sending the signal, TS, the co-moving distance was zero. So we sent the signal at time TS equal, at time TS, and that's when the co-moving distance is zero because we send it from the center of our galaxy. And this fixes what this integration constant has to be. Namely, the integration constant has to be, therefore, 1 over h e to the power minus hts. That is to say, x of t has to be this expression. Because if we choose c like that, then for t equal to ts, that term is the negative of this term, and we have the initial condition obeyed. We just solved the differential equation of the first order. And then we can ask, this tells us, this formula tells us, how far our signal is traveling as a function of proper time. Now let's say we give our signal an infinite amount of time to travel. Can it reach galaxy B or not? Well, for that, we just take the x of t and take the t to plus infinity. If we take t, the time to plus infinity, so we wait for arbitrary amounts of time, then the co-moving distance that our signal has traveled becomes this much, because the e to the power minus ht, you know, that goes to zero, so we are left with that. So the maximum distance, the maximum co-moving distance that our signal can travel during an eternity is this much. The actual physical distance is infinite. I mean, it travels with the speed of light forever, so it will travel infinitely far. But it doesn't mean that it travels an infinite co-moving distance. And remember that, for example, us, we, galaxy A and galaxy B, both of which are assumed not to have peculiar velocities, they will drift apart with the expansion of the universe. But since the co-moving coordinate system expands with it, their co-moving distance remains the same. And that means that this tells us that signals sent from our galaxy can reach any other galaxy whose co-moving distance, and remember that's a constant in time, the co-moving distance, whose co-moving distance is smaller or equal than this distance. And any galaxy that's at a co-moving distance further away from us, hopeless. We cannot send a signal there because the space is expanding between us and them faster than the light can travel that extra distance. And then we can ask, well, okay, what proper distance is that now? Right? So how far is a galaxy allowed to be away from us now so that light will catch up with it and reach it? And what's the proper distance where it cannot reach it? And for that, we just have to translate this co-moving distance into a proper distance now. So how do we translate co-moving distances to proper distances? Well, the co-moving distance is the maximum co-moving distance, the horizon in co-moving distance is e to the power minus hts over h. But the physical distance is scale factor times co-moving distance. So the physical distance, dp, is scale factor times co-moving distance. And you see that the two exponentials cancel each other out, and we obtain 1 over h. So that means, and interestingly, that's time independent now. So it means that in Minkowski, in de Sitter space, any two observers, which at any point in time are further away than 1 over h, the so-called Hubble length, any observers that are further away than 1 over h will not be able to communicate because space is expanding faster than light can cross it at that distance. So the Hubble length is a proper distance. Right? Not a co-moving, it's a proper distance. Anything that's at any point in time this far apart cannot be, can just not communicate. Any closer than that and they can communicate. Will take a long time, of course, but they can communicate. Now, De Sitter space is special because the size of its horizon is constant. In fact, you can define it this way. It's that expanding space-time whose horizon size is always the same. But you can imagine that there are other solutions to the Einstein equation, more realistic ones, in which you have that temporarily, but the Hubble length, the Hubble horizon size is actually changing over time. And that's basically a space-time in which this age is time-dependent, where the expansion is not really exponential. It might be temporarily super exponential or sub exponential, but the age is time dependent. And then you get the time dependent Hubble length size. So 1 over h, the Hubble length, the Hubble horizon size, tells us about the ability of observers to communicate. Right, okay, the left-hand side is what I just said in words. Now, let's switch over to the wave picture. So we are still working with De Sitter space. We know that there is this magical distance, 1 over h. And now we ask, what do waves do? What do waves do depending on whether their wavelength is larger or smaller than 1 over h? Now, the proposition is this, that Klein-Gordon modes will oscillate and behave just normally as long as their wavelength is well below the Hubble length. The wavelength is much shorter than the horizon size, then nothing particular happens. In fact, it's very plausible for now. You see, our universe is accelerating quasi-exponentially now. And therefore, it does have a De Sitter horizon. And it's probably dozens of billions of light years in size. And yet, we don't see this having any impact in daily life because the light and other waves that we are dealing with have wavelengths that are way, way, way shorter than that 1 over h length, which is like dozens of billions of light years across. So the claim is that while the wavelength is short compared to the Hubble horizon, nothing particular happens. However, the frequency becomes imaginary. They freeze. The chi field explodes when the wavelength starts exceeding the Hubble length. Now, in principle, the mass term can mess up that logic. And I feel obliged to mention that because it's a bit of a caveat. And the reason is that the mass term competes with the k-squared term and the a double prime over a term in the omega in the formula for the frequency. So in principle, if you're dealing with a particle whose rest mass is giant, large compared to the Hubble length translated into a mass scale, into an energy scale, then that would interfere with it. But the particles that we do know, like those of the standard model, have, of course, masses that are way lower than the energy scale at which inflation happened, at the energy scale of the Hubble horizon now. Now, of course, in principle, we have a De Sitter space now. And therefore, in principle, we might expect that we have this inversion of the harmonic oscillators for wavelengths that are large compared to that Hubble horizon. But even they typically will not have that harmonic oscillator inversion because the mass is very large, could be large compared to the horizon. But it doesn't matter. I mean, for quantum effects of quantum fields do not play a role at the moment. with this little bit of acceleration that the universe has as a moment, at the moment. Okay, so we want to study what waves do when their wavelength is either below or above the Hubble length. And for that, it's convenient to switch into the use of the conformal time variable instead of the proper time variable. Remember the definition, therefore, of the conformal time. The conformal time is the integral over 1 over the scale factor. And in our case, with the De Sitter space, that's easy to calculate. 1 over the scale factor is e to the power minus ht. So all we need to do is integrate the scale factor up, 1 over the scale factor, and then we obtain that the co-moving time as a function of proper time is this, plus a constant. And we can choose that constant quite arbitrarily. This is not something that we have to fix with initial conditions, because that's not the evolution of any system here. This is just a change of variables, of time variable. So what number we choose for C simply determines where we choose to be. It's a translation of the eta axis relative to the t axis. So what shall we choose? Well, what we observe is that from this formula, we have that no matter what we choose for C, we have that as we go to past infinity, t going to minus infinity, when t goes to minus infinity, we have that this blows up, right? Because we have minus t, and minus is a small number, so it's a plus. And so this thing blows up, and there's a negative sign, so it goes to minus infinity. It's all good. So we have that large negative times in proper time, in cosmic time, is the same as co-moving time, conformal time. Conformal time minus infinity corresponds to proper time minus infinity. And remember, the De Sitter space doesn't have a big bang. It's a space-time that has always existed and will always exist. But now let's look at the case where t goes to plus infinity. Let's look at future infinity. Well, at future infinity, e to the power of minus something growing, that goes to 0 from the left. So what we have is that towards future infinity, the value of eta goes to c. And in the literature, it is traditional to choose, therefore, this constant to be 0. And what that means is that past infinity in conformal time is eta going to minus infinity. Very intuitive. But future infinity actually means that eta goes from the left towards 0, because if you choose c equal to 0. So future infinity on the eta axis is 0. Let me just draw that briefly, because it's so important. So if this is the eta axis, and here is 0, then what we have is that in this direction, where eta is minus infinity, right, that is past infinity, past infinity. And then we are today somewhere here, a finite point in time, and future infinity, all of the time between today and future infinity, is this finite interval here. This is the future. And this point here is future infinity, right? This is not saying anything fancy about the physics of it. The physics of it is trivial. The De Sitter space is simply a space-time that has existed forever and will go on forever, and it's just expanding at a constant rate, exponentially, right? No, this weird behavior is a property of the choice of conformal time. Conformal time doesn't have a beginning. It starts at minus infinity, but it has an end at 0. But it's just because we chose this conformal time variable. And the benefit of that is, as you remember from the conformal time variable when we introduced it, it means that the metric can be written as the Minkowski metric with a scale factor prefactor, right? So it's for technical reasons, for mathematical reasons, that we choose conformal time. And then you just need to remember that future infinity is zero. And all of the future, even though it's actually infinite in length, all of that infinite future, future duration, squeezes in the conformal time variable into a finite interval. It's important to keep that in mind. So what we have is, with this choice of the integration constant to be equal to zero, we have that the conformal time, in terms of the proper time, is minus 1 over h, 1 over a.
Right?
Yeah?
Can I ask you something? Mm-hmm. So if the conformal time is finite, and if the conformal time is the distance or time perceived by a photon, would that mean that the photons will stop at some finite conformal time? And if that's the case, can we...
No. Photons don't perceive time at all.
Right. Yeah, but conformal time would be the distance traveled by a photon. If
we will later see how conformal time relates to the particle horizon. It's basically as far as we can see back. But for the Sitter space, I can't make that argument yet because that would be infinite. So, because it doesn't have a big bang and so on and so on. For now, let's just say that the conformal time doesn't really have a physical representation, at least not a physical interpretation that somehow makes sense, at least not the one that I know. Not for the Sitter space. For later, we will see that there is one, but now, not yet. See, later there will be one, because if you remember from the calculation of how far can our signal to a neighboring galaxy, how far can it travel, right? That involved an integral over 1 over a. So it was very much related to the conformal time. And so therefore, we will be later able to link conformal time to how far we can look back in time. See, the universe might well be infinite in size, but if it is finite in duration, it means we can only see so far away, because anything else it would be outside of our horizon, not the Hubble horizon, but outside the horizon in the sense that, well, whatever happened there didn't have enough time yet to send a signal to us, right? And that calculation boils down to the calculation of the conformal time. But the Sitter space has no beginning, so that calculation doesn't make sense yet. We will see that later on. Okay, so what we have is that conformal time is minus 1 over h times this, which is 1 over the scale factor. So we can write eta is minus 1 over h, 1 over the scale factor. But that also means that we can express now the scale factor as minus 1 over h eta. So what we have now achieved is not only that we have been able to express the conformal time in terms of the cosmic time, we are now also able to express the scale factor in terms of conformal time. We had the scale factor in terms of cosmic time. It was this exponential. But in terms of conformal time, it's this expression. It takes a little getting used to, because we had that the scale factor as a function of cosmic time is an exponential, a growing exponential. And now, what is the scale factor here? The scale factor is this minus 1 over h and then 1 over eta. How can that make sense? How could this be negative? Well, it isn't. The scale factor is positive. That makes sense, because we have a minus sign here, but the conformal time is always negative. Everything happens on a negative half axis of conformal time. So scale factor is always positive. That's fine. And more than that, if eta goes towards minus infinity, well, then this denominator blows up. The whole thing goes to zero. So the scale factor goes to zero. Uh-oh. Yeah, so the scale factor goes to zero. And That's fine for t going to minus infinity or for eta going to minus infinity. Now for plus infinity, the scale factor has to blow up and diverge. And it does. Future infinity is where eta goes to zero from the left. So that goes to zero, the denominator, the whole thing goes to goes to infinity then. Right? So as we approach, as eta comes here from the left, eta goes to zero from the left, we have that the scale factor blows up. In fact, it's exponential in cosmic time, but it's hyperbolic, 1 over eta, in conformal time. So now we can use the scale factor explicitly in our Klein-Gordon equation and mode functions and so on. So we introduce, again, our chi field as scale factor times the phi field. This now plays out explicitly, simply as chi field is equal to minus 1 over h eta phi field, because A is this. And then the chi field obeys this Klein-Gordon equation, where the omega is, as usual, given by k squared plus m squared a squared minus a double prime over a. And now we can express the a explicitly in terms of the Hubble constant and eta. And a little calculation that you can do shows that the frequency, the omega of our mode, is given by k squared plus m squared over h squared eta squared minus 2 over eta squared. And what you can see right away is this. For small eta, that is to say, at late times, for small eta, for eta's close to zero, this term will dominate over that. Except it could be that the mass term is so large that it messes with this, because both of them go like 1 over eta squared, right? So in order for the inversion of the harmonic oscillator to happen, we have to assume that the mass of our Klein-Gordon particles, the rest mass of our Klein-Gordon particles, has to be small compared to the Hubble parameter, which, of course, all of the standard model particles easily obey. In any case, we will see that in cosmology, we get away with the massless case, in fact. So in that case, what we have is that the frequency is determined, the frequency squared is determined by the competition between k squared and minus 2 over eta squared. And therefore, what we see is that, and this will be a theme throughout the next lecture, we see that no matter what wavelength you're looking at, no matter what co-moving wavelength you're looking at, over time, this co-moving wavelength will correspond to larger and larger physical wavelengths because the universe is expanding. And at some point in time, this term will dominate over that one. So no matter what k you choose, every mode will become of a physical size that exceeds the Hubble horizon. In the Sitter space, no mode can escape it. For every k squared, there is an eta such that this thing goes negative. I mean, we are disregarding the mass now. So we check for imaginary frequencies. Remember, that's the frequency squared. So if this goes negative, the frequency goes imaginary, and so it no longer oscillates. And instead of oscillating and having sine and cosine solutions, when the frequency goes imaginary, then we have exponential increase and exponential decrease solutions instead of sine and cosine. OK, so let's check for this. We are assuming here that the mass is smaller than the Hubble parameter. And that means that this term dominates over this one, that one. And so what we're looking for is the case where the sine flips. And for the case m equal to 0, the sine flips when we have that eta is approximately minus square root of 2 over k. That's when this term cancels out that term. So this formula is super important. It tells us for every co-moving mode, when its time has come. When its time has come to stop oscillating and doing funny stuff because its wavelength has grown larger than the Hubble horizon. So fortunately, it's a very easy relationship between the mode's co-moving momentum and the mode's so-called horizon-crossing time. In conformal time, it's very easy to express what that is. It's just 1 over, I mean, minus square root of 2 over k. So what we have is that as long as the time is early enough, so the modulus of eta is large enough, this is much larger than 1 over k, we have that the mode oscillates as usual because this thing might do something, but the k squared is dominating. So it's just usual oscillations. But when the time has, when sufficient time has passed, such that this eta is larger than minus square root of 2 over k, or we just say as soon as eta, the modulus of eta is small compared to 1 over k, then we have that the oscillator is inverted. So in this picture here, we can draw here 1 over k. So for every mode, we can draw its 1 over k value. Right? We draw the value 1 over k. And at times earlier than this, so here, this is, that's not how I wanted to draw it, like here. So at all earlier times than 1 over k, we have usual oscillations. And then from 1 over k to future infinity, this is where we have the inverted harmonic oscillator. This is where we have this extremely non-adiabatic behavior. Now, we can re-express what we wrote in co-moving momenta and co-moving wavelengths in terms of proper momentum and proper wavelengths. Let's do that quickly. So the the conformal time eta is, where is it? Up here. Eta is minus 1 over h, 1 over a. Eta is 1 over h, a. And now let's multiply that with the co-moving momentum. So we just take that equation, multiply it with the co-moving momentum. Then we have eta k is equal to 1 over h, a. And the co-moving momentum can also be written as 2 pi over l. Remember, that's just length and wavelength and momentum relationship. It's this expression here. And the point why we do that is the following. The combination of L, the co-moving length, and A, the scale factor, so A times the scale factor times the co-moving length is the physical length. Right? So what we have is that eta k, eta k is 2 pi over h lambda, lambda being the physical wavelength. So from that, we can conclude that we can express what we found here, namely that this is the critical time. We can conclude that this threshold is the threshold where 2 pi over h lambda is larger than 1. So this is to say that the Hubble length is 1 over h, and this is the physical wavelength, right? So it's the ratio of Hubble length over physical wavelength. So the dividing line between oscillations and the inverted harmonic oscillator, the dividing line is here expressed as a time before eta horizon crossing, the mode is just oscillating. After eta horizon crossing, we have that the mode in terms of chi explodes, in terms of the phi field, it freezes. And here we say that as a snapshot in time, by just translating the co-moving momentum into proper wavelength, we see that the criterion, that is the border, the dividing line between oscillations and freezing, or you know, the non-adiabatic and the adiabatic dividing line, is for the ratio of physical wavelength and Hubble length. So the Hubble length divided by the physical wavelength is what decides it. If the Hubble length is much larger than one, then we have ordinary oscillations. If the Hubble length is small compared to the physical wavelength, then we have this inverted harmonic oscillator non-adiabatic behavior. Okay, this is as far as we got today. And we will refine this a bit more next time, and then we will go to more realistic spacetimes and eventually the actual cosmology. And then we will do black holes. Okay. Any questions? Yes.
Really quick question. So you mentioned that m equals zero is the case that we're interested in for cosmology. Could you explain that again? Like why can we take m equals zero?
Yes. So that's a good question. In principle, the Klein-Gordon field has a non-trivial potential. And you could expand that, and you might want to expand it, and it makes sense to Taylor expand that, and you might get a quadratic term which looks like a mass. However, what we will do is this. We will take the Klein-Gordon equation with its potential, and we will divide, we will separate two parts of it. Namely, we will consider its zero mode, which is to say, we will consider the Klein-Gordon field. If you like, we can Fourier decompose it into its Fourier components. And then we say, we look at the zero wavelength case, which is the constant part of the spatially constant part of the Klein-Gordon field. And that part we will not quantize, because that part we need to describe the interaction of the Klein-Gordon field with gravity. It's the potential of the Klein-Gordon field that dominates the energy momentum tensor, and that therefore drives the expansion and determines the rate of expansion of the space-time. And since we are insisting here that we have an FRW space-time that is spatially constant, we can only take the constant part of the Klein-Gordon field for that purpose. So all of the non-triviality of the potential goes into the zero momentum. It's just a constant in space part of the Klein-Gordon field. And that we use in combination with classical gravity, just the Einstein equations, to determine how the Klein-Gordon field is driving space-time to do what it does, to expand, for example, temporarily, almost exponentially. But then that's not realistic enough. What we also need to do is consider the inhomogeneities in both the Klein-Gordon field and the metric. You can't have one without the other. So we will consider the inhomogeneities of both the Klein-Gordon field and gravity. But these will not have a mass term in them, because the mass term is part of the zero mode, because the potential is not space dependent. Right? It's just phi dependent. And then we quantize that. So we look at the perturbations, the non-isotropies, the non-homogeneities of both the Klein-Gordon field and of the metric, and quantize those. And then we will also be considering, to some extent, how these fluctuations interact between gravity and the Klein-Gordon field. To some extent, that's a kind of quantum gravity, because you're quantizing them together. In fact, it would not be consistent to just quantize the Klein-Gordon field alone. We will have to mix it in with the gravity field, with the metric. It's a non-trivial thing that will take us a bit of... we have to be very careful with this. People got this wrong for a while until, you know, about 20 years ago, they settled on what the right way to do that is. And that's because it turns out that to some extent it's impossible to distinguish a quantum fluctuation of a Klein-Gordon field from a quantum fluctuation of the metric, of some part of the metric. You can change coordinates such that it looks as if you had no fluctuations in gravity and there's only fluctuations in the inflaton field. But you can also choose coordinate systems in which there are no fluctuations in the inflaton field and there are only fluctuations in gravity. That's a gauge symmetry. It's a symmetry, and then you have to ask, well, but what quantities are actually independent of the choice of coordinate system? And we will find that there is a quantity. That's the so-called Mukhanov variable field. And that's the one that needs to be quantized. And then there will be gauge fixing, too, at the end of inflation. I'm already telling you all of that stuff. It's too much, too fast. Yeah, we'll do it systematically. OK? Any questions? Any other questions about today? OK, cool. Have a nice weekend, and see you on Tuesday.